There's a chill in the air. Must be fall. Join me for a tale of Halloween. You will experience tales of horror, ghosts, and death. It is not recommended for the weak at heart. Listen in the dark. It's more fun that way. This is Weekly Spooky.
Hello, my friends. I am your host and narrator, Henrik Kuto, and thank you for joining me for another scary story, especially because it is spooky season. It is October, and we've got a real creepy one for you tonight. A story about love and loss and redemption, and also, well, you know, the pitfalls of becoming a meme. So before we get to this story, though, I do want to say thank you so much. We have had a huge, huge spike of listeners this October, and I'm glad that you guys are here. So if you're listening to this for the first time, second time, third time, whatever, make sure you subscribe on your podcast app of your choice and listen to us every single week. We're going to have one more Halloween-themed episode this month, but then we will be having our big, fat Halloween special, which will debut at midnight on Halloween. So I hope you guys enjoy it. It'll be half fun, half spooky, all the kind of thing you really need this Halloween season. And speaking of things you need this Halloween season, please go check out weeklyspooky.com, where you can find more episodes. You can find links to check out t-shirts. We have a new book called Campfire Stories to Tell in the Dark, which is available right now in paperback, written by many of the great authors that contribute to the show. So check it out at weeklyspooky.com. You can also find information about our Patreon and all of that stuff, but I need to get that all out of the way. I'm feeling spooky. I've carved my jack-o'-lantern. And now, my friends, I want to share a creepy story with you. A story about a policeman, which, granted, is a little political right now, but a policeman who, for once in his life, decides maybe he should do the right thing. But his definition of the right thing is a little unusual. Hang out afterwards and I'll be chatting with you, but for now, let's get to the story. Bad Cop in a Small Town on Halloween Night by John Oak Dalton. Farron didn't know what a viral video was until his daughter showed him a recording of him sleeping in the patrol car in the parking lot of the school. Some asshole kid shot it on a cell phone and sent it to a friend who posted it on Twitter, and the rest went how it went. That was on a Wednesday morning, and by that night, there was a dance club mix with Farron's loud snores and a sample from Juni Morrison's song, Susie Thundertussie. By Friday night, the memes were in full swing. There was a screen cap of Farron sleeping in the patrol car, and the text read, "When you've been racial profiling all day, and the donut shop is out of coffee." And a lot worse than that. Monday night was the town council meeting, and if Farron didn't know anything about social media, he sure didn't think the town council did. But he was wrong. It was a three-person board who met once a month at the library with a handful of old people and a few cranks in the audience. Ellen Soames was the board president and also the town librarian, which was a tough combination. Joe Linseed was a retired farmer who held court at the gas station out by the highway most mornings, but didn't do much here. Buster Winsome was the son of a retired teacher named Ann Winsome, and when she passed away, Buster filled the rest of her term, and then nobody could think of any reason to vote him off. Farron gave his usual monthly report about his speeding ticket quota and one or two domestic calls and one or two drunk driving stops, but he skipped over the fight at the high school because he didn't want to mention the high school. The town board seemed to be listening unusually closely. And afterwards, Ellen asked him to stay and talk. "We've got some changes that have been in the works for a long time," Ellen started. Farron didn't bother to ask what changes. He just stood there. Ellen started back up. "The county has agreed to drive through town a couple of times a day, and the high school has been wanting to hire their own resource officer anyway, so we will need you as a town marshal through Halloween on October 31st, but that's it. Now, Farron reacted. That's this Friday. It's been in the works for a long while, Farron. Can I at least get my insurance through December? That's for Abby. It isn't going to work that way. Ellen looked at him with sorrow on her face, but Farron knew it was for herself. When her son got back from Afghanistan, it was Farron who talked him through what it was like to be a civilian. Farron had gone from high school to Desert Shield, and then had been town marshal ever since, so maybe he wasn't the best, but he was all Darren Soames had. It still didn't stop Darren from ending it all with a Tokarev pistol he shouldn't have been allowed to bring back from in-country. "We can let you resign," she said. "I'm gonna need the unemployment," Farron answered. "Nobody is going to know until the week after Thanksgiving. That's the next meeting." "It's okay. I don't got my daughter for Thanksgiving." Farron walked out. The next day, Farron was sitting in his patrol car by the flashing light on the main street. It was Highway 1, but through town it was called Hadley Street, although everyone called it Hadbin Street. Like there had been a grocery store there. That there had been a bank. And that empty field had been the school, before consolidation. People were speeding and doing rolling stops, but why did that matter now? He was talking to his daughter on his cell phone. "Has the teasing died down at school?" he asked. "It was never that bad. Mercedes dressed her dog up in an octopus costume and put it on TikTok like Wednesday or Thursday. People got into that." "Well, thank Mercedes for me." "Are you going to get in trouble, Dad?" What Abby was really asking was her father going to be able to pay for her college, which he agreed to do as part of the divorce decree 5 years ago, and was happy to make happen. He worked as a bouncer at a bar called the Red Triangle in Ohio on the weekends, which was outside his agreement as a law officer in Indiana, and was why he was asleep Monday morning at his third job as resource officer at the high school. "If I get in trouble, I can get out of it," he answered. "I'll see you on Halloween. I'll have candy in the patrol car." "I'm a senior. I'm too old for trick-or-treating." "Well, walk down there anyways." "Okay." And they hung up. Farron turned on the radio in the patrol car and put it on the country station everybody listened to. His ex was the midday DJ and had done a lunchtime request show for years that Farron still liked. Dolly was singing about how hard it was to be a diamond in a rhinestone world. But then she played a Willie song about the red-headed stranger and the yellow-haired lady, and his heart fell in his chest. Farron was a redhead, and his ex was a blonde, and they danced to the song at their wedding. So that's how Farron knew that the news had spread through the little town about his firing. His ex was playing the song because she was thinking of him. Farron didn't want to think about what it would be like to be an ex-cop. Everybody he'd pulled over and ticketed, when pretty women were let go after a smile and sometimes the promise of a drink or more. All the guys he knew had hit girlfriends or wives or kids or all three and might have accidentally bumped their face on the patrol car or found their paperwork lost for days when they got dropped off at county. All the dealers who were busted because they weren't his dealer. That was all worth thinking about. But having the pity of his ex-wife, that was the worst. And then his thoughts turned to Abby. He could pick up more bouncer shifts at the Red Triangle, but not too many more. And he could go back to doing security at the big outdoor venue where they had stock races in the fall and concerts in the summer, but it was an hour each way and the tweakers were bad. You could put them in chokeholds and kick them in the balls over and over and they just didn't seem to feel any pain or care. At least the Red Triangle had mostly drunks and stoners and only a biker once in a great while. And anymore, most of the bikers were cops and firemen running wild on the weekends, and they always got a pass on their behavior. He might be able to scratch together money, but he wouldn't have insurance, medical, or life, or anything. He had it until October 31st. And then, there was nothing. And a little thought squatted in the corner. And he only looked at it out of the side of his eye until Halloween night. Then Farron sat in his cruiser at the flashing light at Hadley starting around 6 o'clock and gave out candy. He waited until Abby came by and she had dressed up after all and dragged out a couple of girlfriends. And it was all meant to be ironic, but they were having fun. Farron ribbed them, but told his daughter that he loved her, because of the thoughts that had been growing in his mind all week. She was wearing a mask, so he couldn't gauge her reaction. As soon as she was gone, he put the patrol car in gear and drove south out of town, and then a little further. 2 summers ago, during the town bicentennial, they had closed the main road through town and had a carnival come in. But a night or two in, there was an immigration raid of some kind, and all the carnies were dragged off, or ran off. After a few days of complaints and nobody from the carnival coming back, Joe Linseed rode his tractor into town and dragged the rides off one at a time to a farm field the government was paying him to keep fallow. There, those old rides rotted away, along with some busted-up trailers and some other ragged odds and ends. It's where Farron pulled in and parked, and saw a little campfire in the dying light. He knew Joe Linseed's nephews or cousins' kids or some kin hung out here all the time, but Linseed was kind of his boss, so Farron did nothing, even though he had an idea what they were doing out there. Farron took a Remington 870 shotgun out of the trunk and started walking towards the campfire where several figures crouched or sat in broken-down patio furniture. Young guys, still shirtless in the fall chill. There was a chemical smell in the air. "Hello, walls." The call from the gloom brought Farron up short. Only one person called him that, and it was his childhood friend and adult weed dealer, Ricky Webb. He knew his mother had named him after her favorite singer, Farron Young, and had loved his hit song, "Hello, Walls." Ricky was a nephew on Joe Linseed's wife's side, but never came out to this little encampment people up the road called Rusty Town. "You look damn serious, Walls. And all you hillbillies out here look damn jumpy." The energy shifted towards Junior, though who he was Junior to, Farron couldn't remember. He was the lead dog in this younger group and went from juvie to county to state prison and only recently returned from the grand tour. The shining whites of his eyes stared out at Farron, and his neck tattoos looked like bruises in the blue light. "If you want some of that Leopold gold I done brought up from Tell City last week, come by my place tomorrow. You don't need to be out here," Ricky said. "Neither do you." "I ain't never out here, but I got business tonight." "I do too. So maybe you can slip out past that tilt-a-whirl and I'll come holler at you tomorrow for that grass." Somebody snickered. He said grass. "Shut up, Garwood," Ricky said easily, his eyes trained on Farron. Farron gestured with the shotgun. "I tell you what, leaving out Ricky, if there is 8 teeth between all of you, I won't take you whole passel of dickheads in for making and dealing meth." Junior, Garwood, and the others began to move, but Ricky put up a steadying hand. It dawned on Farron for the first time that Ricky, despite his easygoing demeanor, might have been the OG of this loose band of related feral criminals. It was just one more thing he had overlooked, not paid attention to. Let slide. "Walls, why don't you ease on out of this here job? Everybody knows this is your last night as town marshal. Let somebody else worry about this tomorrow," Ricky suggested. Junior blinked. Hell, if he ain't found until tomorrow, it ain't like killing a cop. Junior had a gun in his hand. And then Ricky did, too. Farron just stood with the shotgun loose in his own hands. "We don't need to think like that, cuz," said Ricky mildly. "He knows," said another voice from the growing darkness. Junior nodded for emphasis. "What else would he be doing out here on his last day?" Ricky studied Farron. "That's it, isn't it? It's your last day. Goddamn, Farron, don't let it go down this way. Think about Abby." "You know I am thinking about Abby." It was the truest thing Farron had ever said. "And get her name out of your mouth." Ricky blinked, and Farron swallowed. "Then, tell your idiot half-brothers, or second cousins, or whatever this island of misfit toys is, to stand over against that hall of mirrors with their hands behind their backs, and make this easy." Ricky shook his head. "Head on back to town, old hoss. I'm trying to talk these kids out of making a bad mistake." "It's my mistake. I've been too easy on these young dirtbags because I took most of their mamas behind the football stadium at one time or another." Junior finally lifted his gun, a high point 9mm, just as Farron had hoped. Only Ricky lifted his own Bursa Thunder 380 and shot his cousin in the face. Garwood fired, and Ricky tipped back in his chair, and his legs kicked the air. Garwood turned and fired at Farron next, and Farron felt a hot bite take the bottom of his right ear off. Ricky was up and on his knees pointing his gun at Garwood when somebody stepped out of the shadow and fired at Ricky. A geyser shot out of Ricky's neck, but he still shot again, and Garwood's jaw disappeared in a cloud of red, and his teeth peppered the campfire. Garwood convulsed and fired, hitting another man in the shadows who started to scream. Farron stood and waited for the bullet. But the new gunman turned and ran for the trailer, flannel shirt flapping behind, and the last man broke and ran as well. Farron watched for a moment, then threw his shotgun on the ground. The Remington had been empty, but the Glock 19 in his holster wasn't, and it turned out he needed it. It was one thing to die in a hail of gunfire, and another to die in prison. So he walked up and shot the screaming man, then followed the other two towards the trailer. The one in the flannel banged the door open and ran in, but the other veered off. He figured he had the flannel guy boxed in, but had better catch up to the second guy. That guy ran hell-bent towards what was labeled the funhouse, a big sheet metal box that had been built on the back of a flatbed. The funhouse had some sort of zigzag gangplank held up with chains. And Farron watched for a moment as the guy, who he finally recognized as the recent high school dropout, Peyton Sanford, tried to navigate the wobbly platform in the dark. He stepped into the round O of a painted clown's mouth, and the brake must have been off on that tunnel, because the gears started moving and the opening rolled up like a hamster wheel. It would have been funny if Farron wasn't trying to die in the line of duty. Farron fired into the clown's mouth and missed, but the bullet spanged around and finally hit Sanford and knocked him flat. He tried to get up, but just flopped around in there until Farron drew a better bead and shot him again, and Sanford stopped moving. Farron turned away and saw some weird shapes dancing in front of him. He triggered his gun without thinking and heard shattering glass. He had shot right into the stupid half-assed hall of mirrors. When he saw his own image splintering 100 times, he kept going. Farron beat it for the trailer and quickly realized he'd made a mistake. When he stepped through the door, the chemical smell was strong. He saw a hole that had been knocked in the back wall with a blue tarp strung over it and taped over onto another trailer parked right behind. So Farron bolted through the trailer and out the back, hoping for the bullet that would blow up the trailer behind him and everyone around the world beyond. But instead, he found the last gunman standing in an open field nearby, next to a beat-up 1980 Plymouth Volare Roadrunner. Farron knew the beater belonged to a kid everybody called Baby Gates, because once he got so drunk his friends gated him into a kitchen to sleep it off, and he couldn't figure out how to undo the latch, even when sober. Baby Gates had popped the trunk and had the gun pointed inside, which Farron immediately flashed on. Dogfighting. Even Baby Gates couldn't think he could get out of trouble by shooting up a trunk full of drugs. But Farron went ahead and killed him anyway, then walked over to see what Baby Gates could have possibly been thinking. Inside the trunk was a very thin and pale young woman, wearing clothes you would throw in a dumpster behind the Goodwill. The stench of human smells was strong, but the young woman was alive. Farron bent over and vomited in the grass. Then he felt better. It was the killing of the young men and the finding of a young woman so close to Abby's age. He had sometimes vomited after killing in Iraq and knew that was part of it. He reached a hand out to the cowering, feebly moving woman, but finally just reached down and lifted her out and set her on the ground. She was a flat 5 feet and didn't weigh 110 by Farron's eyes. "What's your name, miss?" The young woman just stood and shook, her teeth chattering. "Can you tell me your name, miss? You're all right now." The young woman slowly opened her mouth, and Farron saw a darkness within. It took Farron a minute to realize the woman had no tongue. Farron looked into her eyes. "Okay, we'll go back to my patrol car. I got a paper and pencil there so you can write your name down." The young woman shook her head. "You don't want to write your name down?" She shook her head, harder. The truth punched Farron between the eyes. "How long ago did you get taken?" The young woman lowered her hand until the flat of it hovered around her knee. Farron felt the bile rise in his throat when he thought about the enormity of what had happened to the young woman. Okay, well, we still need to get back to the patrol car. Just keep your eyes on me when we walk that way and don't look at nothing else. The young woman nodded, and Farron led her away from the Roadrunner. But as he neared the campfire once more, he saw movement again. He raised a hand for the young woman to stay where she was, and Farron approached the fire, where his old friend Ricky was somehow still alive, holding a bloody hand to his neck. Farron stood over him. "You ain't calling this one in, are you, old hoss?" Ricky asked. "No." Farron could see Ricky's eyes slide sideways in a glimmer of firelight. "I'm glad she's still alive. If it means anything to you, I thought Baby Gates was talking shit, some stupid internet thing. I didn't think he could really go and get a girl from somewhere. I was here to make Junior let her go." "That does mean something. Where was she from?"
"I don't know exactly, but they bought her in Indianapolis. But I know where she was going. They sold her to them people out at Comfort Farm."
"Comfort Farm? Where they had those retreats? My ex went to a writer's group out there.
Them people went bankrupt 2 years ago. This is a different group. They're from Jersey."
"Jersey? East Coast people, man." Farron thought on this for a moment, and when he looked down, Ricky was dead. The young woman was standing and looking. She didn't resist when Farron put her in the front seat of the car. He started the patrol car and turned and looked at her. "I'm going to take you into town and drop you off at the flashing light. There are good people there, and somebody will call the police and the county will respond." She grabbed his bicep and wouldn't let go. "I can't take you with me because I'm going out to the farm where they were going to take you, and I ain't planning on coming back." The young woman grabbed and clawed at him so hard that instead of making a big U-turn to town, he turned off the car and started walking back towards the Roadrunner with the young woman a ghost trailing behind. He took the keys out of Baby Gates' jeans pocket and threw his uniform shirt on the ground and put on Baby Gates' flannel, which only had some blood on it. He didn't say anything when she got into the passenger seat. Then Farron bumped over the farm field and onto the highway and straight into darkness. Comfort Farm was right at the very edge of the county and probably out of his jurisdiction if he was thinking hard about it. But what he was thinking was that he should have noticed somebody building a watchtower on the other side of the big cattle gates. Farron idled there and finally honked the horn, and damned if a big spotlight didn't shine out of the tower and point right at the Roadrunner. Farron and the woman sat, very still. After a long moment, he heard a deep-throated rumble, and here came a 1987 Chevy El Camino, black on top and silver on bottom, that he couldn't help but admire. Some long-haired guy with a leather vest over a bare chest came out with a Mac-10 in one hand and a gym bag in the other and stood on the other side of the cattle gates. Farron waited, knowing he had a flannel up top, but uniform pants and a gun belt below. The guy squinted at the Roadrunner.
"You're supposed to keep her in the trunk, idiot."
Farron said nothing as the man started to undo the chain holding the cattle gates together. Just for fun, Farron revved the engine and gunned it as the chain fell away and banged the gates open and knocked the long-haired guy backwards and watched his limbs turn counterclockwise. He heard a gunshot from above, and so he drove straight on into one leg of the tower and crushed the grill of the Roadrunner. He heard a crack and a creak as the wooden leg gave way, but what happened next was hidden in a cloud of radiator steam. He opened the driver's side door in time to see a guy fall from above and bounce off the hood of the car, an AR-15 going flying. The guy scrambled for his weapon and slid off the hood of the Roadrunner, and Farron shot him before he could get his feet under him. The long-haired guy was somehow on his feet and firing into the steam. Farron bent down and scooped up the AR-15 and let it rip into the darkness. He liked it better than the Mac-10 anyway. He heard the long-haired guy scream as he walked over to the El Camino, accidentally kicking the gym bag on the way. Money spilled out onto the dirt. Farron couldn't believe what he was seeing, but he picked up the bag and threw it in the back of the El Camino anyway. Somewhere down this dirt road, the big barn you could rent for weddings was all lit up. There were two guys walking down the path towards them. All the little cabins they used to rent to church groups were all boarded up on both sides of the overgrown track. They had definitely heard a commotion, but weren't in full tilt panic yet. These East Coast types didn't think much of Midwesterners, Farron thought, sourly. He climbed into the El Camino, and there was the young woman sitting there already.
"You gotta get out of here. You got me through the gate, but that's as far as I was planning on going with you. There's a bag of money back there. Take it and walk to town."
She started grabbing at him again, so Farron just put the El Camino in gear and started slowly rolling down the dirt road towards the men in the barn. This one was absolutely not the 1970 El Camino he had lovingly finished restoring when his older brother got sick of it, but it was better than no El Camino at all. When he got close, he floored it, then braked hard and knocked both men down in one swing from the long back of the car. Farron got out and reached into the back where he'd seen a tow chain laying. He pulled it out and hit one guy with it and watched the hook hit him on the ear and yank part of his face onto the ground. Then Farron got the other guy as he was standing up and wrapped the chain around his neck.
"What's in the barn?" Farron asked, pulling the chain tighter. But he must have pulled too hard because the guy went limp, blood running from his mouth, and Farron just dropped him in the dirt.
Farron climbed back behind the wheel and told the young woman to duck. Then he floored it one more time and drove right at the big barn doors. They didn't bust open as dramatically as he thought, since he was pushing 45 or 50 by the time he reached them, but they splintered well enough that the El Camino went on through and went in a long skid as Farron pumped the brakes. Farron jumped out with the AR-15 and the Glock 19 pointing straight ahead and saw he was in the middle of a big space all painted red. The barn beams, the floor, everything. There were big bright lights everywhere and little cameras with red lights. There was medical equipment in the corners and chains hanging down from above. There were men and women in animal masks. It was the stupidest thing Farron had ever seen. He felt tired. He'd gone this whole night and hadn't met anybody with the juice to kill him. He didn't think any of these people could either. Then somebody stepped up with an ornate-looking knife, and when Farron stuck his hand up to block it, the guy drove it right into Farron's palm. Now something was happening, he thought, and he lifted the Glock and blew a hole in the masked man's face. Bone shards blew back and cut his cheeks, and he realized it was a real skull of some kind. Not some Halloween Town plastic shit like he thought. Farron tried to steady himself on the hood of the El Camino and work the AR-15. Somebody with a metal pole ran up to him, and too late Farron realized it was a cattle prod. He tried to kick, and it hit him in the leg and jolted him clear to his balls, and he went down on his back, involuntarily. The masked man threw the prod aside and came thrusting downward with another fancy knife, but Farron scrambled under the El Camino and popped up on the other side, shooting. Farron could hear a low keening from the front seat and realized it was the young woman, but couldn't do anything but kill everyone in front of him and hope she would get it together enough to finally run away. Some woman in a flowing red robe rose from behind a bank of computer monitors and started saying some shit Farron couldn't hear between the rumbling of the El Camino and the sounds of gunshots and the keening of the young woman and the screams of the dying. He shot her, thinking the rest of them might stop fighting when they saw it, but they didn't, and somebody stabbed Farron up around the collarbone, and the blade deflected off and screeched across the El Camino's paint job. The Glock was out of ammo, and so was the AR-15, and now he wished he hadn't thrown that Remington shotgun on the ground. But it was all right. He felt about done. But then he started thinking about what that young woman, or even his daughter, or both of them, could do with a bag of money. And he grabbed the guy who stabbed him around the neck and beat his head onto the car hood until he dropped the bloody knife. Then Farron took it and tried to slit the guy's throat, but it skittered off the bone of the guy's mask. And then he thought maybe this was just a shitty knife and threw it on the ground. He picked up the cattle prod and used the business end on some asshole with a big hook knife and then swung at the computer monitors, and it sparked and sputtered and, surprising everyone, started a fire. Then there was a sharp pain in his back, and he half turned and saw somebody whose wolf mask was half hanging off was stabbing him with a scalpel from the table full of medical instruments. And it was some guy he had seen 100 times jogging on the historical trail out where the old railroad had been.
Then Farron got pissed, because it was one thing to die in the line of duty, and it was another thing to die of a thousand cuts from a bunch of dirtbags who got all their ideas from beating off to death metal videos. So he headbutted the guy and clawed at his scalpel, but couldn't get it loose. He heard a loud chick-chick behind him and saw some douchebag holding a Mossberg pump-action shotgun pointed at him. Farron grabbed the barrel and forced it upwards, upwards, until he forced it under the guy's chin. The blast showered Farron with gore, but he'd lost track of whose blood was whose. There was somebody running away from the growing flames, and Farron brought the barrel of the Mossberg down on his head, and the guy stumbled and fell. Farron wiped blood from his eyes and didn't see anyone else running or moving at all, just the steady red lights looking at him from every angle of the room. And so he lay down next to the last corpse and let the fire warm his feet and waited to see if anything else would happen. Unfortunately, Farron woke up not in that red room, but in a white room, the county hospital, and there was a little boombox covered in stickers on the bedside table, and his wife was talking on the radio, and he knew that the boombox belonged to his daughter, and she must have left it there, and he must be alive. His daughter came in and started crying, and he did too, not for the same reasons. After a few minutes, he asked, "Who's the girl?" "They don't know yet," Abby said. "Everybody's somebody," her father whispered. "You're a meme again," Abby said, showing him her phone. The video was called "Sleepy Cop Wakes Up," and somehow there was heavily edited video of the massacre at Comfort Farm. "What is this?" Farron asked, pushing the phone away. "You shouldn't be looking at that. You busted up a red room. It's where they take girls to be tortured and people pay to watch it on the dark web." "The what?" "The bad part of the internet." "There was a good part?" "Somebody put the video out. They said they thought the red room was a hoax, so they were recording it, but they are probably just saying that now because they're trying to stay out of jail." "Speaking of which, that guy outside the door looks like a fed." "I don't know what he is, Dad. I reckon he wants to talk to me." "He does, but I had to get in here first. By the way, Mom has your phone and is taking all your calls." "She's doing what?" "The password is still your anniversary, Dad." "Okay, okay. What calls?" "People want to interview you. Pay for your story. A big podcast called." "What's that?" "It's on the internet." "You can get paid for that?" Abby snuck a glance at the door, where the man in the dark suit and red tie loomed. "Dad, I think they want your help." "I'm not a cop anymore." "The town council extended you. Mom got on the radio and raised hell because you were all stabbed and whatever and weren't going to have any insurance." Farron felt like crying again. It had to be the drugs. "Well, she's a good woman." "The town council still sucks. They only extended it till December 31st. Farron tried to shrug. "Small victories." Farron closed his eyes, and when Abby left and the Fed came in, Farron was sound asleep. So you see, my friends, it's never too late for a fresh start. As long as you manage to kill a bunch of weird, creepy, quasi-Satanist, dark web murderers. That was a really fun story, and thank you so much, John Oak Dalton, for writing it just for us to present to you all here on Weekly Spooky. I have been very pleased by not only how creepy our Halloween-themed stories are this year, but how varied they are, and we have another one next week that I think you're really going to enjoy. But I also want to mention real quick, because if I didn't, I would be selling the show short. If you enjoy the show and you want to support us, go to weeklyspooky.com. You can buy merchandise, you can tip us, or you can join our Patreon, which we have hit 80 patrons on Patreon. That's the most we have ever had. Thank you so much. When you join the Patreon, you not only get exclusives involving Weekly Spooky, but you also get exclusives involving my short films, my feature films, and also my photography, which sometimes can be a little spicy, so that's a little warning for you, but also an advertisement for you. And I want to thank real quick our Patreon boosters, the people who are contributing specifically to get their names mentioned on the show.
Karen We Met, Jack Kerr, Jeff Hilton, Craig Cohen, Rob Fields, and Kevin Fry. Thank you guys for helping us make the show happen. So my friends, I am going to go enjoy the Halloween season. I'm going to watch one of the later movies in the Halloween movie series and have a good laugh. And I hope you are having a safe and happy Halloween season and you're ready to hand out candy in the most medically safe but spooky way possible. So until next time, for our producer Dan Wilder, our composer Ray Mattis, and myself, please keep yourself spooky. And come back next Wednesday for another story. Thank you so much, and I'll talk at you later.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to find your way back next week. But for now, you are safe. Trust me.